Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome to episode 259 of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. My name is Brian Salvatore, and thank you for joining us on this episode, the Mickey Callaway edition. Doesn't that name sound like a tough guy from a 1940s movie? Like a gangster movie, Mickey Callaway? I love it. Such a fun name to say. But Mickey Callaway is the 21st manager of the New York Mets. He's coming to us from the Cleveland Indians. And what is... he had what was just such a delightful press conference. He seemed so affable and fun and just really a breath of fresh air. So I'm very excited. I know lots in the Mets community are very excited, especially after that press conference. So we reached out to a sister SB Nation site, Let's Go Tribe. They obviously cover the Cleveland Indians for SB Nation and wanted to see if one of their staffers wanted to come on and talk about Mickey Callaway. We were thrilled that Merritt Rolfing decided to answer that call, and he spoke with myself and Chris McShane about the new Mets manager. So let's check that out right now. Well, folks, we are in the first 36 hours or so of the Mickey Callaway era of Mets managerdom. I don't even know how you would quantify that into a word. But we have a new Mets manager, and he was the former pitching coach for the Cleveland Indians. And so we thought it would be good to reach out to somebody who knows a little bit more about the Mets new manager than we do. So Let's Go Tribe is the SB Nation Cleveland Indians site, and we have on the line tonight Merritt Rolfing. Rolfing, I promised I was going to get that right, and I messed it up. Merritt Rolfing from Let's Go Tribe to talk with us about the Mets new manager. How are you tonight, Merritt?
You butchered my name like everyone else does, so I'm
yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah, but I try and be better than that. You know, that's not
all
cool.
Right. I expect it at this point. It's lots of L's and H's and O's and stuff. It's an oddball. So I'm great, though. So thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. So Chris and I just basically want to get your basic impression, first of all, about Callaway. What was his overall impression that he left on you during his time with the Tribe?
Well, Mickey Callaway. All right, so when you think of a pitching coach, usually your mind reaches back to someone like Dave Duncan or Don Cooper or Leo Mazzoni back in the 90s with the Braves, right? And they all seem to have a specific thing that they like preach to their pitchers, whether it was Mazzoni wanting guys to really hammer the lower outside corner, really expand the zone. We saw that very well with Greg Maddux. Or Dave Duncan really preaching the sinker and pounding the ball down in the zone and that sort of a thing, I suppose. It's hard to kind of condense a pitching coach's entire kind of lesson into a sentence, but whatever. Callaway, I never really got that sense that he ever really – kind of preached a specific thing. And I mean, everything I've written about him so many different times about what he does, because I like trying to understand pitching. It's a very interesting part of the game because it's the very center of the mental game between batter and pitcher, and being able to kind of capture that is I don't know, it's fascinating to me. And Callaway never really gave me an idea that he was ever telling his guys to do a certain thing, but instead to do what they do the best, I suppose. Everything I've read about him was he was a good like psychologist or a psychiatrist for his pitchers. He had a lot of young pitchers with the Indians. Trevor Bauer obviously being the most headstrong and interesting, but Carlos Carrasco had some kind of maturity issues early on when Callaway came up. Corey Kluber turned from the most average pitcher in history to... Well, Corey Kluber, saving them. Mike Clevinger is on the cusp of, I think, of making a huge leap. None of these guys have anything really in common, except they all do throw a lot of curveballs. Indians have thrown more curveballs than any other pitcher or any other team in baseball. Whether that's just because Corey Kluber happens to throw a great one, or saving Trevor Bauer, that was the pitch that really got him drafted. So to answer your question, I think he was a good sounding board, I suppose, for getting young pitchers used to the hard parts of Major League Baseball, I suppose. I don't think that the Indians, or rather, I do think that the Indians have a a grander, I suppose, structure in developing it, pitchers than just Mickey Callaway. But I think he's kind of the capstone to it all. They get there and they have this kind of calming influence to help them kind of ease into it. I got to go to an Orioles game this past summer when they were playing the Indians, and I got to watch Clevinger warm up. And just seeing Callaway sit behind him, it's not really say much to him while he was warming up. But like every now and then, like he'd just like, you know, say a word or something. Clevinger would look back and nod, and then, I don't know, make some little adjustment or something or other. Do other pitching coaches do that? I don't know. I don't spend a lot of time watching pitching coaches warm up with their pitchers. But he just seemed so involved in the just in every bit of what his pitchers were doing in a helpful sense, like telling them this, do this a little bit better. So I think that's what he does. He's kind of just a like a psychiatrist for the players, and just someone they can talk to and work with to get better and be their own best selves, I suppose.
You know, we watched the introductory press conference yesterday, and he came off as an incredibly likable guy, very affable and positive and all that. You know, I know that pitching coaches tend to not get a lot of time in front of the microphone, but is that typically how you saw him as well? Did he come off as exuberant and positive when in Cleveland as he did yesterday?
I wouldn't say exuberant, really, simply because I think he obviously had to take a backseat to Terry Francona. But I also think Terry Francona is going to surround himself with guys who are affable and interesting and fun and a good conversationalist. Because this is the guy he talked to most of the game anyway. You figure he's going to be the best conversationalist on the team. But no, I would say that is the kind of guy, from everything I've seen of Callaway, just the way he never seemed, you know, mad on the mound, like when his pitchers were blowing it. He seemed to make a joke every now and again, kind of calmed him down. Yeah, I would say that would be a good way to describe him. He's definitely a he just seems like just a nice guy, I suppose. In addition to being, I don't know, he does something with pitchers, and I don't know what it is. Yeah.
Chris?
Well, I guess I would, you know, just touching on a couple of the points there. We've been very used to now former Mets pitching coach Dan Worthen, who was around for a long time, mm-hmm. became, you know, known for the Worthen slider. And it was really awesome when it was working for everybody who was healthy at a certain time. But that combination of working and healthy didn't really last that long.
Mm-hmm.
So everything you've said, it's sort of just a contrast. Obviously, he's a lot younger than Terry Collins or Dan Worthen. You know, he's taking over the role, of course, that Terry Collins had. But it's just interesting to me to hear that sort of individualism that he has with these guys. And I think that's something he really tried to emphasize in the press conference was, you know, this is about the players as people and, you know, understanding things are going to come up and we'll get through them as a team, but everybody's their own individual. That focus is coming through in what you're saying about him. But Worthen was a guy who we like never heard speak. I think the only thing I can say I remember him saying publicly was an infamous line when he referred to John Maine as a habitual liar. which may or may not have been true, but it's a weird thing to have stand out about your tenure. So I think I had read somewhere that Francona, when the Indians made it to the World Series, made a point of having Callaway come up with him for a press conference, I think, either at the end of the ALCS or the beginning of the World Series, something like that. I was not particularly tuned in to that. Do you have any recollection of what that story was, or, you know, what that was like? Because that sounds so foreign to us.
Right. No, and I think part of that, too, is just, and that's kind of what you're going to be getting with Callaway, too, is, he's been working. They didn't know each other before he became the pitching coach for the Indians, but they become seemingly very close friends. So that's kind of what you're going to be getting with Callaway. It's kind of you're getting obviously a Francona protege, but that's what Francona does too, right? Like he he never takes credit for what his teams do. He never did when he was in Boston. He never has when he's been in Cleveland. And I think that's just what you saw with him bringing Callaway up to the podium with him, because he knows that Callaway is the one working closer with with the pitchers, and he's a large part of the reason why they were where they were, right?
Yeah.
So I would say it's and I think that's what you're going to get with Callaway now is, I mean, I hate saying he's a player's manager or isn't. I think he's just a guy who recognizes he's dealing with a bunch of grown men. Well, to a degree, it's a bunch of grown men who never grew up and they go to summer camp every summer and play with their friends. But, you know, he deals with these grown men and he wants them to succeed of their own merits. And I think you're going to be getting that with Callaway too. The only worry I would have is, and I think this is probably going to be something that will be run with, especially in the always delightful New York press, is Mickey Callaway can't be the pitching coach, obviously, right?
Right.
Like, this is going to be a situation where, like in football, when a great offensive coordinator or defensive coordinator becomes a head coach, will it go well, or will you have, well, in New York terms, will you have Rex Ryan, right? Will you have a situation where it's just he doesn't care about one side of the ball? And you can't do that with baseball. And I don't right. think that you're going to be getting that. Like, I don't think he's going to do some magic touch on the New York rotation. I don't think they really need a magic touch, to be quite honest with you. They're incredibly talented. I mean, the fact that Matt Harvey is probably their biggest question mark, I think, if anything, is awesome, because if he gets it right again, you know, that I think that rotation is going to be dynamite next year. And I don't think it'll all be Callaway. I think it'll be health, obviously, but
man, I love your optimism. Optimism about the Mets pitchers. That's
well, you know, I'm eternally optimistic, I suppose. I don't know. I don't know where it comes from. I'm an Indians fan. It's very strange. I know.
I have a question about that. Sorry, Chris. Did you have something you wanted to say?
No, go ahead. Go ahead. I'll come back to it.
What I was going to say is, you know, there's one of the things that Terry Collins was really knocked for during his tenure as the Mets manager is his bullpen management and how he just, I mean, destroyed people's arms on a regular basis. And I think that, you know, for a lot of fans, we're sitting here thinking, oh, thank goodness somebody who's going to consider the pitchers. I don't think anybody was necessarily thinking that he was going to ignore the offense. And I know you weren't suggesting that at all. But I was wondering if Francona, you think, had any particular tendencies when handling a pitching staff, and if those tendencies could possibly be attributed back to Callaway.
I mean, Francona's always kind of had his guys, I suppose. At least with the Indians, they always just happen to be really, you know, really good, especially the last couple of years. I mean, it's a good question. I don't know. He had this propensity to keep on putting Zach McAllister in games. And even though I wrote an article about him maybe being good, he was never all that good. So that always bothered me. But aside from that, no. I don't think he really had any bad tendencies in particular. I'd say the biggest knock I always had on him was maybe riding Corey Kluber too much at times. Like, he doesn't always have to throw 100 pitches.
Right.
But he just had him throw, even if he, you know, just kind of throwing a bit of a clunker out there, and he's only going five or six innings, he still just kind of left him in there. Again, it's very easy to manage a good bullpen when you have a good, or to manage a bullpen well, rather, when you have a good bullpen. And the Indians have had anywhere from decent to great Francona's entire tenure. Like, even when he came there, Cody Allen was their fourth or he was the fourth guy on the depth chart, pretty much, when it came to the bullpen, and because they still had the Chris Perez and Vinny Pastano. I say, you know, like, no one really remembers these era. This is me paying too much attention to the Indians.
I remember Vinny Pastano. Somebody who plays in a fantasy league that includes holds.
Oh, okay.
That guy was legit for a couple of years.
He was a beast. I wrote several articles about why is Chris Perez closing? This guy is terrible. But, I think that it'll come back to the pitchers. I don't think Callaway is going to abuse anybody, but the Indians, like I said before, they did also have a structure behind Callaway of development of pitchers that led to, I think, stronger arms. I mean, you'll read a lot about their their use of more advanced techniques for pitcher training. I mean, Trevor Bauer has popularized a lot with weighted ball and plyometrics and the extreme long toss. But that's not just a Trevor Bauer thing. I mean, I watched Mike Clevenger do the exact same warm-up routine that Trevor Bauer does when I went to go see him pitch, and no one really talked about that anymore. But the Indians are very forward-thinking when it comes to pitcher development and pitcher kind of rehab. I don't know where the Mets sit in that. I know they've had some terrible – I know that, you know, I still pay attention to New York, you know, sports media because I don't know. I grew up around there, and I know that they have a much pilloried medical staff. I don't know whether that's going to change down the line, but I do know they need better pitching. It'll be very easy to blame Mickey Callaway for problems that the – I mean, they didn't have a very good bullpen this year, did they?
Not particularly, no.
No, yeah, okay, yeah. So, I mean, no. It's hard to be a good bullpen manager when you don't have a good bullpen, I suppose. If you have five good arms, then you're not going to lean on anyone or develop any tendencies because you can just kind of reach into a hat and pull out Brian Shaw or someone like that. I mean, so.
Right. Well, one thing that I'm kind of curious about, and I don't know, this isn't really so much of a question, but just kind of building on this stuff, if the Mets get into a situation where guys are healthy or healthier than expected and they have one or two starters who might be hesitant to go to the bullpen, I think that's where somebody, you know, if his personality that we saw, and it's, we understand it's easy to like fall in love with a guy who's just being introduced. He hasn't done anything wrong yet. You know, every manager is going to make moves that lose games that fans are going to get upset about. You know, sure. we know that's coming. But if the impression he made is how he goes into the season, you have a guy like Zach Wheeler, who we've talked a lot about on the podcast and written about on the site. You know, he's a guy whose arm just doesn't seem like it's capable of throwing 150 innings a year. And that's not even really the goal as a starter. But even that seems like it's not something that's attainable. So I'm just curious to see if, you know, the fresh face and voice and everything can convince somebody like Wheeler to make the move to the bullpen and maybe become that kind of arm, an extra good reliever. And then on the point about, you know, overall pitching development and everything, obviously the Mets have had a really good pipeline to get guys up to the majors and have them succeed. You know, Michael Fulmer had come up through the system and has flourished with the Tigers, which, you know, fortunately for you.
I forgot about that. Yeah, he did come from the Mets. Yeah, that was a Cespedes deal, wasn't it?
Yeah,
was
yeah.
It? Yeah. Yeah, it was. Yeah. Okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but fortunately for you, it hasn't really hurt things too much.
No, I mean, the Tigers stink, so, I mean, right, he can be as good as he wants. I don't care.
He's great on a terrible team that is only going deeper into a rebuild with Ron Gardenhire. Brian, I'm turning this into an AL Central podcast now.
Oh, what's going on? Yeah, sure. Let me tell you about Ron Gardenhire. No, go on.
Former Met, yeah, Ron Gardenhire.
It's kind of a long-winded way for me to just say that, like, the willingness to just look at things a new way is exciting, and I think we would have felt that way with any manager, but somebody coming in and being that excited about it, about getting the job, you know, getting his first opportunity to manage his own team. In the press conference, he made a reference to, you know, someday I want to be where Sandy Alderson is, and then quickly backed that up with like way down the road. But, you know, somebody who has developed this career in baseball and wants more on day one. It's all really encouraging, and it's just, I don't know if I was really getting to a question here.
Well, I mean, it sounded like you were asking half a question with the Zach Wheeler point, like, do you think he'll be able to kind of convince guys who are hesitant? And I'll say this, he did do it twice just this year. Danny Salazar was, you know, bouncing back and forth, having health issues, not being able to maintain velocity, this and that, the other thing. And eventually, in the second half, he did get moved to the bullpen, kind of a combination of, I mean, they actually did it with Carlos Carrasco, as a matter of fact. He was actually able to, he had to have been in the room for these conversations, right, because he is the pitching coach, to convince Carlos Carrasco to go to the bullpen be great in the bullpen. And then he eventually came back, was healthy enough, and has now, for the last 2 years, been a great starter for them. And if you look at his numbers out of the bullpen when he first, or rather back in the rotation, I mean, he had a sub-3 ERA. He was incredible. He's managed I would put Zach Wheeler probably in the same basket as, say, Mike Clevinger, someone who is fighting to get into an already pretty stacked rotation. And he had earned it. His role in the rotation just by pitching very well for multiple months, but they didn't need him there. So Callaway was again able to convince him to happily go back to the bullpen for the good of the team. And I can't imagine this will be a thing that he wouldn't be able to do with the Mets. I mean, once he gets to know these guys, and maybe that'd be a part of it too, is he kind of came up with all these young guys with the Indians, especially. So maybe that'll be a bit of a learning curve. No, I don't think that'll be a real problem. Again, he's a personable guy who is able to, work with guys to put them in the best place to succeed. And I think he'll be able to convince Mets players of that too. Cause I mean, obviously they want to succeed too. They've had back to back very disappointing years.
Yeah.
What was the second part of what you were saying?
I have a question if you're in the weeds there, Chris.
Well, maybe a little. Go ahead.
One of the things that Alderson has spoken about and was reported at the end of the season was that part of the team's frustration with Collins over the last couple of seasons, and this is, I think, a problem always, but when you're winning, well, let's put it this way, when you're expected to be bad and you're bad, or when you're expected to be good and you're good, these things kind of get swept under the rug a little bit, but when you're expected to be good and you're bad, people take notice of the things that you do that don't necessarily jibe with the front office. And the front office, especially Alderson, is very, very statistic, sabermetrically inclined. And Collins was, I'd say, as far from that as most people get, mm-hmm. And so there was a reluctance for him to do things like construct the lineup differently and just, pay attention to sort of the more sabermetric principles in the game. And so I know that the Indians are a very forward-thinking team. Do you know if, obviously, if you're part of an organization like that, you're going to somewhat reflect that. But do you know if Callaway has any particular affection or fondness for advanced statistics? Or do you think that he's more of a, as we said before, sort of a traditional guy? Yeah.
I'll look at it two ways. Again, he's a guy who worked with Trevor Bauer rather than against Trevor Bauer, because Trevor Bauer famously, he is the guy who shook off Miguel Montero in his first ever start. He's a guy who pissed off the entire Diamondbacks front office with his quote-unquote antics, just because that's just how he warmed up. It's how he's always warmed up, and it was the way he thinks it will maintain health and develop velocity and make him a better pitcher just in general. The guy's a maniac when it comes to discussing pitching. And rather than fighting that, Mickey Callaway has worked with him to, maybe tone down a little bit, but I mean, he's let the young man kind of go his own way. So I would say that kind of speaks to a willingness to be forward thinking. And again, he worked with Terry Francona for basically his entire major league coaching career so far, and he's seen Terry Francona do things like move Carlos Santana to the leadoff spot, as he did, which worked so well. Play around the use of Andrew Miller, which, I mean, that's a luxury very few teams have, is to get an Andrew Miller type of player who realizes his value goes beyond just the save. But no, I mean, again, we're talking about a guy in his late 30s, early 40s, something like that?
He's 42. He's, yeah, okay. It makes me feel incredibly old that the Mets manager is only a couple years older than I am, so.
Oh, dude, at some point, we're going to get to a point where we see guys' sons that we saw play be managers, aren't we? Yeah, we're going to get there at some point. My dad's already told me that. That's when you know you're really old. But, no, Francona, in his own way, is very traditional. He has certain ways of doing things, I suppose. I mean, but he's, I think in many ways, if you look at someone like Francona's lineups, the perception of tradition is actually a bit of a loyalty thing. Like, he kept on putting Jason Kipnis, who was a quote-unquote prototypical number two hitter, I guess, in the two hole, even though Kipnis was having a terrible year. But I think that was more of a loyalty thing. Same thing with Michael Brantley, where he kept on putting Brantley batting third when he was obviously the fifth best hitter in on the team. I don't think the Mets front office would have hired him if not for it. We are in an era where someone like a Terry Francona is an outlier, a personality on the field as a manager who really seems to be leading the way. Whereas realistically, if you really watch how it all operates, it's much more of a symbiotic relationship with the front office. I mean, you have other teams all over the place where the manager is a little more than just a puppet for the front office. Places like, I don't know, I think the Padres, I could not tell you who their manager is. I could tell you who their general manager is. I don't know who their manager, but it's just the general manager has become the man in charge, the face of the franchise when it comes to management these days. And I don't think that Sandy Alderson and them would hire someone who's going to be, just stuck in the old way of doing things. Because the old way of doing things is how you lose. You can't do that. I mean, if if the Yankees are going to commit to a forward thinking way of doing things, and they have the greatest resource glut of any team in all of baseball, with the exception of maybe the Dodgers, a team who themselves hired Andrew Friedman of all people to run the show, and that's just worked out super great. So no, I think this is all a long way of saying no. I would not be even a little bit worried about Mickey Callaway doing things in an old, antiquated way, because that's just not how you win baseball games. And even though they do play in New York City, the Mets are in many ways a small market team, or at least run like one or something. I don't know. We all know of their past money issues due to the Madoff situation and whatnot. So no, I think they'll be fine. I think they hired the right guy for the job. Probably. Again, I can't help but keep on going back to the whole, can a great offensive coordinator be a great head coach? I don't know. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, it's weird. As somebody who, always has baseball first, that is a comparison that I've made myself at this point. And like those guys in football, is there anybody else who was with him in Cleveland? It's kind of rare to hear about this in baseball, I would say, but was there anybody else, like a bullpen coach, a bullpen catcher, anybody who was particularly tight with Callaway? I don't know if I wouldn't be able to answer that with Dan Warthen on our end, but
I'm just thinking about, because I mean, Franco has been talking about Callaway being a manager for 2 years now, essentially, and he always wants his guys, his friends, who are also talented, to move up. And so I'm just kind of thinking about guys who maybe not faces I see on the field, whether the third base coach or what have you. But, like, Scott Atchison is their major league advanced coach and staff assistant. Travis Fryman is a special assistant with the team. So they're around. And I can't help but wonder if someone like Scott Atchison might become, like, the pitching coach.
Oh, man.
Former Met.
I mean, he's like 65 years old, so he brings a good a good old man voice to the team. But
my younger brother used to call him Uncle Dad, and this is the perfect nickname for him.
Mets Twitter and the Amazing Avenue community all had tons of dad jokes and everything for his tenure. It was brief, but
I wouldn't be surprised
that
if
would
got him
go
back.
Over. I mean this genuinely. It would go over really well, at least at first.
Yeah. I think he's going to be a major league coach at some point soon. And right now he's just an advanced scout and kind of he's with the team, but he's just kind of not visible with the team. And I've just kind of been kind of thinking of other guys who are like that. I don't know anything about their bullpen catchers. I don't know who Armando Camacaro is. I've never seen Ricky. I can't pronounce his last name in real life. Maybe I have. I don't know. But yeah, maybe. I would say though, if you see someone like Fryman or Atchison or some of these special assistant type guys, I don't want them to take Sandy Alomar Jr. away. I'd be very sad if that happened. I want him to stay forever. He's a perma Indian. But I mean, like you said, it's not something you see commonly. But we're also dealing with a guy who this is his first foray into management. This is his second job as a major league coach also. So maybe, I don't know. Seeing someone compile a pitching or a coaching staff, I don't know how they do it. Again, Francona did not know Callaway when they first met. He was just suggested by someone else. He said, yeah, sure. They met him and he was like, this guy's the man. Let's go with him. And it did. And it worked out very well.
I guess my next question, and Chris, I don't know how much more you want to keep Merritt on the line for, but we, even when there is a coach or a manager that is beloved by the fans and by his players and all that, there's still sometimes a knock on him. You know, there's something that you recognize that they are maybe not so great at. Was there a knock on Callaway at all? Was there anything that he was sort of infamous for or, you know, known to do that wasn't necessarily all that popular among Indians fans?
I mean, I don't know, man. They've won more games than any other team in the American League since he's been on the team, so it's hard to be mad.
That is true.
And their pitching staff has only gotten better every year. I don't know. It's hard to figure out what to point to with. If anything, I love him the most for how much he's pushed curve. I love curveballs. I think it's a neat pitch, and it's fun in an era of ever increasing velocity to see guys just flail at curveballs. You know, we saw them, you know, make the fool of Aaron Judge time and time again in the ALDS until it all went to hell. And that was all curveballs, man. It was super great. They did it last year too. I can't really think of anything. Everything's worked out for them so much in the last 4 years since he's been with the team. So no, it is honestly, it seems a little hard to say. I can't think of a knock of what he does on him.
That's a good thing for us to hear. You know, it's
yeah,
a good
no,
thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, I got me thinking about it. I don't know. I don't know. He kept them too healthy. I got same faces constantly, man. It was ridiculous. I want some variety in my life.
Be a Mets fan for 5 minutes, and you'll
get plenty of teams. Yeah.
You have plenty of pitching variety.
Yeah.
Chris, anything else to add?
No, I think that sums it up. I've learned that the Indians don't have a bullpen catcher who goes around the country setting records for amounts of food he can eat.
What? Oh, man, you should be a Mets fan. They have that?
Yes. Dave Racanello. I believe it's 17 cheesesteaks.
Yes.
That almost sounds low. Maybe it was 27. I think it ended at a 7, but some absurd amount of cheesesteak that he ate in one series in Philadelphia, just as an example.
I mean, I went down there one time to eat cheesesteaks, and I swear I ate 7 in about 25 minutes. They go down smooth, but that's a lot of cheesesteaks.
They do.
He first came
I,
on.
I made a.
Go ahead, Chris.
What a hero.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm just going to mention my 24-hour trip to Philly in which I exclusively ate cheesesteak.
Mm-hmm. That's how you should live.
I was proud of that.
What I was going to say was I first became aware of Dave Racanello, bullpen catcher, because when David Wright was like the hottest thing in New York baseball, Racanello used to carry his PS2 around for him. Like that was what he was known for. Like he was Wright's traveling video game buddy, and like we would pack his PS2 so they could play games on the road. So
I love it.
Yeah,
I mean, get some bullpen catcher jerseys now.
I remember thinking, you know, because Wright's about my age. I was like, you know, 22, 23, thinking, man, I wish I had a friend who would travel with me and bring video games for me to play. So you know, seemed like a pretty sweet gig at the time.
Yeah, right. Jeez, what a great. I mean, bullpen catcher is like, you know, it's like backup kicker. That's not even a real role. Bullpen catcher is a great job.
Or is it the worst job?
That's a good question. We wonder if you're doing a lot of wild guys. Yeah.
You're just constantly squatting. You don't get the glory. You never get to hit the ball. You know.
You eat 27 cheese sticks, though. And no one complains about you having a stomach ache the next day because there's another bullpen catcher, apparently.
That is true. A friend of mine used to always say that the way you could tell if you're a real fan of a team is if you could name at least one of their bullpen catchers and at least one of their Spanish language broadcasters. So I have since forgotten the second Mets bullpen catcher, but I know that their Spanish announced team, at least for a long time, was Juan Alacera and Billy Baroa. So
I don't even know if the Indians have a Spanish language broadcasting, to tell you the truth. Do they? No, I'm looking into it. They don't. They actually don't have a Spanish language broadcasting. Northern Ohio never changed. Gee whiz.
I guess my last question for you is, you're a guy from Connecticut, you live in D.C., and you're an Indians fan. How does that happen?
Yep. My godfather is from Erie, Pennsylvania, and I grew up in the mid-90s, and I was, my father was a Red Sox fan, I was not allowed to be a Yankees fan. No one wanted to be a Mets fan. I wanted to not be a Red Sox fan because, you know, we all hate our fathers in some way. My godfather inundated me with just gear from the time I was able to remember anything. And then, the Indians were just kick-ass for most of my formative years. I mean, my favorite player of all time is still Albert Bell. Not Jim Thome or Manny Ramirez, but instead Albert Bell for some reason.
I was hoping you were going to say...
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I was hoping you were going to say former Met Carlos Baerga was your favorite.
No, I actually always had a big problem with Carlos Baerga.
Really?
For no good reason. He became the scapegoat in my mind for all their inability to win championships in the 90s. For no good reason, but I needed something in my mind, and it became Carlos Baerga being the reason.
Oh, wow. That's the hottest that's the hottest take of the podcast so far tonight. So.
You know, scapegoats, man. You got to have them. They're important when you're young.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, anyway, Merritt, where can folks find you on the internet if they want to experience more of your tribe love and wit?
Well, I write at Let's Go Tribe. I post a couple times a week. I also write over at Beyond the Box Score, the other SB Nation kind of sabermetric-y site. I have a podcast called Mostly Baseball. We post pretty much weekly. We talked a lot about basketball last week. We're both Indians fans on it. We didn't want to talk about baseball at all. it made us very sad, so we just kind of talk about other stuff. And then my Twitter handle is at Merritt Rolfing, MerrittRolfing. If you see a sandwich as an avatar, that's me. It's been my same avatar since I got the account. Still love sandwiches more than anything else, so, you know, you gotta stick with what you love.
As we have had national sandwich expert Ted Berg on the podcast more than once, what is your favorite sandwich? It's a good place to end.
Wow, that's a good question. I guess we're going to be here for another 20 minutes, aren't I? Depends on the situation. I mean, I guess I'd have to go with just a really good Reuben, though. You know, a nice marble rye. I'd go with a nice Reuben. I judge a place based on the quality of its Reuben if they have one, and you know, if they don't have a bad one, I'd leave. If they have a great one, I'd keep on going back. Yeah.
I will say this in our further attempts to convert you to a Mets fan, they do have Reubens at Citi Field.
There's a place. Oh, you know, never mind. It's a Bobka ice cream sandwich place down here. It's not a Reuben at all. Reubens, though, eh? I gotta go to Citi Field. You may have me.
If the Mets play the Indians next year, come up and be our guest on the podcast. We'll record a podcast live at Citi Field and we'll eat some Reubens.
I love this idea a lot, and I'd love to do that. I know a lot of people up there. I think I might actually do that. That'd be fun. Yeah, I'll hold you to that.
Hi, this is Aaron York for Amazing Avenue Audio, and before I get to the main topic of my segment today, which is going to be the World Series... let's talk about the new Mets manager. It's Mickey Callaway, the pitching coach from the Indians, who had a lot of success at his old job. When he first joined on with the club, he was able to help resurrect the career of Scott Kazmir, who was thought to be done from baseball. And then he ends up developing a staff that includes the likes of Corey Kluber and Carlos Carrasco and Trevor Bauer, and they've been one of the best pitching teams in the majors over the past few years, and that's what made Callaway such a big candidate. And it kind of came out of nowhere for the Mets, because it looked like they were going to choose between Kevin Long and Manny Acta, who no one was really excited about, and then they make sort of a splash with Callaway, even though he doesn't have major league managing experience. It seems like the guys who don't have experience like Callaway are more valuable nowadays because they haven't been driven off the lot. They haven't been able to screw up yet. And Callaway's, I'll be clear, unless the Mets win a championship next year, Callaway's value is only going to go down because people only focus on the bad decisions. So guys that have managerial experience, like, for example, Brad Ausmus, they see their value only drop and their experience kind of seen as a negative these days. So I think that's interesting, which is why I think there's some hidden gems in the pool of guys who have already managed and quote-unquote failed. But it's hard to argue with the signing of Callaway. Pretty much all the people who cover the team were happy about this. We know the Mets have a stable of young pitchers that have not all of them have lived up to the hype, especially this past year with the injuries and Matt Harvey just falling off a cliff. So you can't blame the team for wanting a pitching coach as its next manager. So so we'll see how well it works out. I thought his press conference was interesting. It was a little sugary. He was like, yeah, we're gonna make sure that all the players know that they're individual humans and we're not gonna treat anyone like a number, and I'm just so excited to meet everyone. And yeah, he should be him. He shouldn't pretend to be someone he's not. You could already see the headlines from the first 3-game losing streak that he's trying to be friends with everyone, that he's not being hard enough on these guys. You could already see it coming, but hey, it's Mickey Callaway's team. Mickey Callaway should manage the way he wants to manage. I'm just saying because I guess, I mean, a lot of Mets fans are negative people, so that doesn't make me special. I could already see it coming. But look, every manager, if a manager's gonna be tough, then when he loses, the criticism's gonna be he's too tough. If a manager's too friendly and he loses, the criticism is gonna be that he's too friendly. So let's just hope that the Mets spend a little money this offseason, give Callaway the tools he needs to avoid too much of that criticism that is bound to come after the honeymoon is over. So let's move on. We got the World Series. It started on Tuesday night in a shocking fashion, not because the Dodgers won a 3-1 decision and Clayton Kershaw finally maybe had his postseason moments, which we knew was going to happen. If he pitched enough postseason games, eventually this guy was going to be tremendous, because he is tremendous almost every time he takes the mound. So that wasn't surprising. It was surprising that the game only took 2 hours and 30 minutes after this postseason has been plagued by games that have lasted way more than 3.5 hours. I think 3.5 hours is around the average length of game, and a lot of them have gone over that. It's really just been a pleasant surprise when games go under 3.5 hours. And if they go long because of extra innings, that's one thing. If it's a lot of them are going long because there's a ton of pitching changes and there's mound visits and the pitchers don't want to throw the pitch. But that did not happen last night, as Dallas Keuchel and Clayton Kershaw are both decisive. They're both working quickly and they're throwing in the strike zone. And that was a enjoyable game of baseball, if not the most dramatic game of baseball. Although I think Justin Turner's game-winning home run came in the seventh inning, so that's pretty good. It was tied pretty late in this game as Alex Bregman and Chris Taylor both hit home runs to tie the score at one. And yeah, then Turner won it. And a lot of the talk today, because you can't really complain about the length of the game, now people are talking about the advertising, which you could tell Fox was experimenting with a lot of things. I thought it was really interesting. A lot of people didn't like it. We'll get off the bat. The first thing is that they're calling it the World Series presented by YouTube TV, which was on the big Fox graphic. Apparently, it's been on MLB.com that they're calling it the World Series presented by YouTube TV. And this is something that's it's not the greatest thing, but if you're a college football fan like myself, this is something that you're used to, because every bowl game, even the big bowl games, even the Rose Bowl, which is probably the most famous one, has a presenting sponsor these days. So for the World Series to have one, it's certainly different, but it's not uncharted territory as far as big sports events are concerned. And yeah, this is probably going to continue to be a thing, but as long as the World Series comes first, there's not too much to complain about, at least in my opinion. I'm sure some people will be more upset about it. But like I said, this has kind of been a thing in other sports for a long time. So hopefully the jersey advertisements aren't something that follows this. But with the, you know, we see how it's going with the NBA. That could be a thing down the line. But the other topic I want to talk about with World Series advertising is these little 15 to 30 second spots that they play with the ball game in a window that they play during mound visits and in between at bats. And I've seen some negative backlash on social media, but I don't mind it, especially if it's taking away from longer breaks in between innings, because there's already dead time. Like, that time is already there. If you could start selling advertisements for this dead time between at bats and when the pitching coach goes to the mound or when the catcher goes to the mound, you can hit a spot there. And if you can have that take away from the time in between innings, which I don't think that was the case last night, but it's something to think about for the future, I think that's a great thing, because then you're basically getting more baseball, because the time that you're playing the spots during is going to be there anyway, and there's not any action happening. So why not take advantage of that and put an advertisement for Wendy's chicken tenders there? They looked pretty delicious. Is that they're not a sponsor? That's just saying what I was thinking during the game. But yeah, that was interesting. I'm just surprising there were so many complaints. It'd be one thing if the advertisement was while they're pitching, which would be absurd. You don't want to get to that point. As long as we're seeing all the baseball, I think it's fine that they're getting sponsors in during the time when nothing is happening. And probably a lot of people are complaining just because they're noticing it. Like, we're used to having the advertisements in between innings and going to the bathroom or whatever and just ignoring it. But when the advertisements start to show up where we don't expect them, we start to notice them more. And maybe that's what leads to the complaints, because I don't think they were too disruptive to the baseball game. But that's just one guy's opinion. So that is my segment for today. This has been Aaron York for the Amazing Avenue Audio Podcast, and enjoy the World Series.
The five greatest postseason games in Mets history might as well be referred to as the five greatest games, period. That said, here are the best of the best. And at number five, it's the fifth and final game of the 1969 World Series. 6 months prior, such a happening was beyond the realm of comprehension. For a civilization that had recently witnessed such an otherworldly event as a moon landing, the Mets, National League cellar dwellers for most of their 8 years, were on the brink of an accomplishment that registered as much awe as what took place some 239,000 miles from planet Earth. Up 3-1 on mighty Baltimore, one last touch of fate intervened in the bottom of the sixth, down 3-0, and the Orioles attempting to take the series back to their home. Cleon Jones claimed he was hit on the foot by a Dave McNally pitch. Home plate umpire Lou DeMuro wasn't convinced until Gil Hodges brought DeMuro the ball, which had skipped over near the dugout, bearing a smudge of shoe polish. DeMuro reversed his decision and awarded Cleon Jones first base. The next ball was promptly vaulted airborne by Don Clendenin, 3-2 Orioles. Al Weiss, starting the bottom of the seventh, then hit his first Shea Stadium home run to match the Birds at 3-3. 2 doubles and 2 Oriole errors in the eighth resulted in a 5-3 Mets lead. Jerry Kuzman, who had allowed 4 hits and 3 runs over the first 2 innings, yielded 1 over the final 7. The final pitch was sent deep to left field. Jones, on the warning track, began to kneel as he secured the clinching out, almost as if to acknowledge the heavens for a title distinguished as providential. The Mets, 100-1 odds to win it all when the season began, were world champions. On to number 4, and it's Game 7 of the 1986 World Series. The postscript to the epic theater that occurred 2 nights prior was anything but a fait accompli, even if you choose to believe New York was supposed to win all along. A Sunday rainout allowed Red Sox manager John McNamara to give the ball to Bruce Hurst, and he began by reinforcing his case for series MVP. The Mets relied on a lefty of their own, Sid Fernandez, to hold Boston in check, except his 2.1 hitless innings were done to limit the damage against starter Ron Darling. Like 1969's clincher, the Mets spotted their opponent a 3-0 lead, and like 69, the sixth inning was rally time. Lee Mazzilli and Mookie Wilson started with singles. Tim Tuffle walked, providing a ready-made moment for Keith Hernandez. He muscled a Hurst pitch into center field. Mazzilli and Mookie scored. The next batter, Gary Carter, looped a fly ball to right field. It couldn't be hauled in by a diving Dwight Evans. Wally Backman, pinch running, came in to score the equalizer. With beleaguered Calvin Schiraldi taking over with a tie score in the seventh, Ray Knight, soon to be series MVP, drove one over the left center field wall. New York scored twice more, so did Boston. But Daryl Strawberry's leadoff homer in the eighth all but sealed the deal. The Mets won 8-5, ensuring that Saturday's dramatics were less a footnote than a catalyst. Now to number three, the 1999 NLCS Game 5. The tightrope the Mets had walked, placing one wobbly foot in front of the other, for 2.5 weeks, began to fray. Walt Weiss scored on Keith Lockhart's triple in the top half of the 15th, breaking a 2-2 tie that had been maintained since the 4th. A 5.5-hour tension-filled trek through the late afternoon and into a rainy evening was 3 outs from ending. So, too, the hypnotic, thrilling journey of Bobby Valentine's team. The Atlanta Braves thought it had the Mets dead and buried by dominating them in late September, and again when taking a one-run lead into the bottom of the eighth of Game 4, and again tonight. But here came another encounter with ghosts of miracles past. Sean Dunston led off the bottom of the 15th and worked young Kevin McGlinchey for 12 pitches before singling up the middle. Matt Franco worked a walk. Edgardo Alfonso, in his ever-understated way, sacrificed both runners 90 feet further. With the base open, John Olerud, responsible for the entirety of the Mets' scoring up to that point, got an intentional pass. Todd Pratt somehow had the chance to reprise the dramatics of 8 days earlier, yet he barely had to swing the bat. McGlinchey, obviously rattled, walked in the tying run. Robin Ventura, pained by ailments that still couldn't keep him off the field, could send everyone home, and both teams to Atlanta. His big league career included 18 grand slams, which is sixth all-time. From the crack of the bat to the ball landing in the space between the right center field fence and the humongous scoreboard several feet beyond, it was a grand slam in the most classic sense of the description. Except his over-exuberant teammates wouldn't allow Ventura to enjoy his home run trot. Instead, they mobbed him in the path between first and second base. The result of the play, forever a grand slam single, was of little significance to the joyous Mets. Whether the final score was 4-3 instead of 7-3 didn't matter. They had risen from the dead once more and lived to play another. The number two game is Game 6 of the 1986 National League Championship Series between the Mets and the Houston Astros. Jesse Orozco's 16th inning strikeout of Kevin Bass ended such questioning of a seventh game possibility, and ended a game that enclosed as much sustained tension as any in playoff history. But the end is nothing without context. Even though the Mets held a 3-2 lead, the prospect of Mike Scott, the pitcher who made the mighty Mets look mortal in games 1 and 4, loomed like a grim reaper in the hallway. Houston starter Bob Knepper was turning that possibility into probability with each passing inning. Gifted an early 3-0 lead, the lefty barely broke a sweat as he was in total command, with a two-hitter through 8 innings. The outs that separated the Mets for Scott dwindled. Then, similar to the sixth inning of Game 3, New York's offense solved the riddle. A Lenny Dykstra triple, a Mookie Wilson single, and a Keith Hernandez double forced Knepper's ouster. But Dave Smith was of little resistance. Two walks preempted a Ray Knight game-tying sacrifice fly. This too-close-for-comfort escape from defeat had raised the tension level that had already been on high. It would only get higher. After Roger McDowell completed his remarkable fifth shutout inning, Wally Backman drove in Daryl Strawberry in the top of the 14th. The Mets were now on the verge of celebration, two outs, in fact, from the National League pennant, until Billy Hatcher spoiled those plans. He towered Jesse Orozco's offering deep down the left field line and into the screen that substituted a foul pole. New York, though, retained equivalent amounts of resilience as their opponent, not letting the backbreaking moment serve as momentum enough to carry the Astros further. Knight's opposite field single scored Strawberry in the 16th. Two additional insurance runs came across, which turned out to be invaluable security, as the Astros continued to disdain relent. They answered with two runs, and had two runners on with two outs. Kevin Bass stepped in. Like the game itself, Bass and Orozco ran the count to its peak, before Bass swung and missed on a 3-2 curve. Houston's mystic year had dried up, leaving the Mets with time to enact more miracles in the days ahead. Now to number one, and you can probably guess by now, it's Game 6 of the 1986 World Series. Down two runs and down to their last out with no one on base in the bottom of the 10th, even outrageous believers who had witnessed the miracles of 1969 and 1973 could be convinced that their team, one that unflappably prevailed 116 times dating back to opening day, could surmount this position and save the season. The rowdy, raucous, rambunctious Mets were about to go quietly into the night. It's replayed often, but never too often, the four at-bats that will live on in memory. First it was Gary Carter, who had tied the score at 3 with an 8th-inning sacrifice fly, lacing a single to left off Calvin Schiraldi. Then it was Kevin Mitchell, pinch-hitting for Ricky Aguilera, who had surrendered the Dave Henderson tie-breaking home run in the top half of the inning, delivering a base hit to center. Ray Knight, having been fitted for goat horns for his 7th-inning throwing error that led to a Red Sox go-ahead run, fighting off an inside 0-2 pitch and placing it in front of center fielder Henderson, allowing Carter to score and Mitchell to move to third. Mookie Wilson rarely ever saw a pitch he didn't like. Ever the free swinger, he took a hack at the initial offering from Bob Stanley and fouled it away. He took several more swings, then watched a pitch go by, and Kevin Mitchell came in to score. Inexplicably, the game was tied. But there was time for another event that was even more outrageous. A ground ball fitted with destiny's eyes. Around the glove and through the legs of Bill Buckner it went, dispatching Shea into its most exalted state. That's all for this list. I'm Brian Wright. You can follow me on Twitter, at BrianWright86.
Well, folks, that does it for another installment of Amazing Avenue Audio. Thank you so much for listening. We truly appreciate it. Please go to Apple Podcasts and rate, review, and subscribe to the show. That really does help us. You can also find the show on Stitcher, directly at blogtalkradio.com, or on your podcatcher of choice. We hope you enjoy the show however you listen to it. We also hope that you check out AmazingAvenue.com for all your Mets news and information in the offseason. We have been doing a season review series from all the players that played for the Mets this past year, and we'll be getting into some free agent profiles soon. It's almost AAOP time. It's a fun time, even though it's the off season and it's a slow time of year. With Callaway's introduction to the team, it seems like optimism is on the rise, and that's a good thing. And you'll find optimism, analysis, and more at AmazingAvenue.com. You can also follow all of us contributors on Twitter. I'm at Brian Edenapp. Chris is at Chris McShane. Brian Wright is at BrianWright86. And Aaron is at Aaron P. York. We would also love some emails to help us get through this offseason. podcast@AmazingAvenueAudio.com is the email address. Check it out. Send us emails. And we'll be back next time.
I think I speak for everyone on the site when I say we are rooting for the Astros because they have the best ex-Mets and because Curtis Granderson is not even on the Dodgers World Series roster. So until next time, let's go Mets and let's go Astros.